Okay, Ms. Batista, you want to go ahead?
Sure. Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is Catherine Batista. I'm arguing for the defendants, Real Estate Mortgage Network, Security Atlantic Mortgage Company, Noel Chapman, and Samuel Lamparello. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Okay.
The defendants are appealing the District Court's June 26, 2019, order denying defendants' motion to compel arbitration and finding that defendants waived their right to enforce their arbitration agreements.
Let me ask this. When was the first opportunity that your client had to raise the issue of the arbitration clause?
It was first raised during a discovery discussion between the parties in September of 2014.
That's when it was first raised, so the question was, when was your first opportunity to raise it? Your realistic opportunity, given what the pleadings were.
Given the state of the pleadings, there was no opportunity to procedurally raise it until December 2017 when the first two opt-ins with arbitration agreements joined.
The question is whether you should have raised it. Don't you agree it's significant that while a change in plaintiffs had arbitration agreements and knew of their agreements from the start, Ms. Thompson did not have any such agreement and did not know the other possible plaintiffs did execute arbitration agreements until you revealed this fact years after she filed a complaint?
The complaint was filed in March 2011. The procedural history in this case is also obviously significant. The defendants filed two motions to dismiss on completely unrelated grounds, going to the allegations made by plaintiffs in the complaint that they weren't sufficient to against the individuals and employers and to convey successor liability. The first was granted, and then plaintiffs filed an amended complaint, and then defendants filed a motion to dismiss the amended complaint on similar grounds. So any mention of the arbitration agreement, which plaintiffs didn't have, would have been completely irrelevant at that time.
Even if you ultimately prevail on the actual scope of a putative collective class, don't you agree that the possible participation of individuals with arbitration agreements and the effect on such agreements were clearly issues before you revealed the existence of the arbitration agreements? You played it fast and loose, let's put it that way, no question about it.
Your Honor, I disagree. This case is not one where, like so many, where waiver is considered, where defendants were hedging their bets and seeing where they would be more successful. The arbitration agreements in this case had the very probable likelihood that they would never come into play. The arbitration agreements were only given to a small pool of putative class members, many of whom it's completely possible that they never would have joined this action. We are now 9 years into litigation and only two have. So this wasn't a significant issue.
Out of how many? Two out of how many possible?
There are two who have joined now. There are only eight plaintiffs in this case. But in looking at the pool of underwriters who were in New Jersey, as the geographic scope has been limited through litigation, there are only five more who even have them.
Okay.
Well, did you actually suggest in your response to Ms. Thompson's first motion for equitable tolling that there was nothing to stop potential members of the putative class from opting in or filing their own lawsuit? Wasn't this misleading, to say the least, without you at least mentioning the existence of the arbitration agreements?
Your Honor, I think in looking at this litigation with the benefit of hindsight, obviously I understand that point. But at the time, we were defending against a motion to toll the statute of limitations that was based on the procedural posture somehow impeding putative class members from joining. And so in making that assertion, the point was simply that defendants hadn't done anything but pursue the procedural rights they have to pursue in a litigation that would otherwise prevent those punitive class members who were eligible to join from joining. It's not as if our filing of motions to dismiss had somehow obstructed that. In hindsight, it may have been an artful not to also state that they could have joined the litigation or filed their own arbitration claims. But from the defendant's strategy at that time, it was merely to rebut plaintiff's argument that our filing of motions to dismiss at that time had somehow prevented or created some sort of extraordinary circumstances that prevented plaintiffs who were eligible from joining and justifying tolling.
Well, I don't know. Instead of calling it inartful, I would call it your conduct misleading. You held cards and you didn't want anyone to know what cards you were going to spring on them. It's for that reason that both the magistrate judge and the district judge found your conduct to be totally opportunist.
Your Honor, I beg to differ. There was no opportunity there. If arbitration agreements would have somehow made the class smaller at that point or dissuaded plaintiffs from pursuing the litigation, that would have been to defendant's advantage. Why wouldn't we have advanced it? The point was that...
I'm not sure I follow that argument. If the arbitration agreement would have inured to your advantage, but how would it have... Well, I see you're saying that you would have gotten that out of court and you would have been anxious to get out of court and into arbitration because that's what you had bargained for. That's what you're saying.
Right. There was no – it certainly wasn't opportunistic. It didn't give defendants any advantage not to raise it at the time. It simply just wasn't relevant at the time. And, you know, to your point, defendants weren't making the point at the time when they said that that there was nothing that plaintiffs – that defendants had done to dissuade or somehow obstruct the plaintiffs from joining. That was with respect to their conduct thus far at the litigation, which was what was at issue in the motion for tolling.
Could I ask, it's Judge Bibas. Could I ask you about Chasson? You're relying a fair amount on it, but this case is not exactly futility. You could have mentioned this arbitration clause earlier and disclosed it. So Chasson's holding doesn't exactly reach this case.
I believe it does. In Chasson, the Third Circuit's reasoning was that it's not logical to apply the Hawksworth factors, which, as you well know, are the standard six-factor test that the Third Circuit has established in analysis of waiver, that it wouldn't be logical to apply those in an instance where essentially a litigant's hands are tied because moving, otherwise enforcing, or attempting to enforce an arbitration agreement would be futile.
5 minutes.
And the court there specifically defines futility as an instance where it would be almost certain that a motion would be denied. And certainly we have that here. That's what the defendants anticipated. And the district court expressly held that to be true in the June 29, 2015 order denying plaintiff's motion for tolling. The court expressly held that it wouldn't consider a motion to compel prior to any opt-ins with arbitration agreements joining because to do so would be to give an advisory opinion. So that solidified that it actually would have been futile to try to enforce the arbitration agreements prior to December 28, 2017, when the two opt-ins with arbitration agreements actually joined. And in addition to that, it's not as if this wasn't or plaintiffs weren't on notice of the arbitration agreement until they actually joined. The facts here are that plaintiffs were on notice of the arbitration agreement as soon as the case was remanded and months after the case was remanded, once the parties actually started getting into the litigation on the merits. I think it's significant here that unlike a change in the law where a litigant would essentially be guessing whether or not a motion to compel would be futile and guessing how the court would rule, we knew how the court would rule, and we were right that the court held that it wouldn't have entertained that motion prior to any opt-ins with arbitration agreements actually joining. Once that happened, the defendant promptly, on the next motion filed, they joined in December 28, 2017. The next motion filed was our defendant's opposition to plaintiff's motion for conditional class certification. And our opposition was filed on February 2nd. And in it, defendants advised that they would be moving to compel arbitration for those two new opt-ins, which defendants did on February 16th. So we're talking about only a few weeks from when it became a viable defense to when defendants actually moved to compel. I think what can't be overstated in this case is that there simply was no prejudice to plaintiffs. Plaintiffs have been aware of the arbitration agreement since September of 2014, and this was never an instance where these arbitration agreements could have uprooted a lengthy and time-consuming and costly litigation from federal court into arbitration. This class action or collective was always going to go forward in federal court. The only difference is that there may have been a handful of individuals who opted in who were then compelled to arbitration. As I said before, right now that's two. Looking at the pool based on the geographic scope, there are only five additional who have arbitration agreements. That's not a significant effect on the overall class or collective here.
You know, you may have answered this already. How much motions practice was there before the arbitration clause was asserted?
Complaint
was filed, obviously.
There were two motions to dismiss, an initial and then a motion to commit to dismiss the amended complaint. And then the case was pending before the Third Circuit for, I believe, 18 months. And then it was remanded. After it was remanded, there was one more motion. In that time period, plaintiffs moved to toll the statute of limitations. But after the remand, defendants answered the complaint and discovery commenced. Further, just to expound a bit on plaintiffs' argument that this has created some type of prejudice, it's simply not realistic that plaintiffs would have not pursued the case or the named plaintiff would have not accepted settlement had she known or had they known about the arbitration agreements. Again, if that were the case, if defendants believe that to be true, we would have brought them up sooner. Rather, this was just a small part of the overall defense strategy, a defense strategy against the litigation that was always going to be in federal court. Even if this court decides to apply the Hawksworth factor, still there can be no waiver found as defendants timely raised the issue once the parties started litigating on the merits. They moved to compel as soon as possible and only contested the motions and engaged in motion practice and discovery as required to assert their defense comprehensively against the rest of the class that was still pending in federal court.
And is it fire?
Good.
Okay, we understand your – I didn't hear what you said, Greg. Was that the time up?
Yes, counsel's time has expired.
Okay, and I think you reserved some time anyhow.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Batista.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Schlenk?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honors, this is Mitchell Schley. I represent plaintiff Patricia Thompson and as well as the Rule 23 putative class, as well as the FLSA collective with respect to the claim that overtime was not paid to employees who work more than 40 hours a week. I have some prepared remarks. However, what I have heard is deviates so much from the record that I have
control
to
yourself. Let me ask you about her,
that's fine.
Her point. Is her arbitration clause, yeah, her class arbitration clause, why wouldn't they have asserted it as soon as they were on notice that the arbitration clause was being ignored by some plaintiff? Why would not they have asserted that? What would have been their motive for remaining silent?
The motive here for not mentioning it to plaintiff nor the court in 3.5 years is because what defendants did, as the court below found specifically, was to play tails I win, heads you lose. They tried vigorously to get the case dismissed, and hoping that they would, and they did twice, and then they thought it would stand, and then Third Circuit reversed. So they were hoping that the case would be knocked out. So they kept it to themselves. Meanwhile, no one knew about this. And then after, so now they said, oh, now the case is real. Plaintiff has spent untold dollars, time. The courts, district courts, written multiple decisions. The Third Circuit wrote a massive decision on this case. Then they said, okay, now we'll let you know. So what they did was exactly the whole point that arbitration was created. It was created to take the courts out of the process and give it to an arbitrator. But what plaintiff, what defendants did here was cynical and unacceptable and has been rejected by this court and all courts across the country.
Now, counsel, you might be right. You know, your brief highlights, they've changed their story, they've said some misleading things, but why does that fit within waiver doctrine? That sounds like an estoppel argument based on misconduct, but the district court never addressed that. You know, they asserted, they sought arbitration reasonably at the first opportunity they could, so the logic, if not the holding of Chasten, applies. Why don't we leave this as an estoppel matter for the district court rather than stretching our waiver doctrine?
Your Honor, this is not a stretch of the waiver doctrine. One, Hawksworth, Third Circuit has set out six factors.
Okay, but we don't get to Hawksworth unless we get past Chasten. And so I'm asking about the logic of Chasten.
Okay.
Chasten says, you know,
I understand the point, Your Honor. I'll address it.
Reasonable opportunity.
Chasten, I'll tell you why Chasten is not applicable here, and why it's so different. In Chasten, the plaintiff and the court knew from the point the complaint was filed that arbitration agreements were present. They knew. They just simply said that since the law at the time was that bilateral arbitration was not effective until the change in the law by the Supreme Court's decision AT&T, that effectively the arbitration agreements that everyone knew about could not be utilized. We didn't know about the arbitration agreements.
Let's say you could not have arbitrated, and they could not have arbitrated that early, correct? You're not disputing that you couldn't have arbitrated before late 2017, right?
Yes, but there's a bigger point, and that's what Hawksworth and its progeny deals with. The issue isn't only whether we could have arbitrated. The issue is what was the effect of concealing the arbitration on the parties and the court? It created prejudice. Why? Because this case was filed as a class action. A class action is not a situation where you have to wait for someone to opt in. That's an FLSA opt-in procedure, which means you have to opt in. A class action is you have to opt out. So if we obtain class certification, every single person would be in, going back to the day the complaint was filed.
But they didn't obtain it initially, though.
Exactly. But the point is that the defendants has a right to know under the law, which is the third factor in Hawksworth, when they're conducting their case, they have a right to know that this case may well end up in arbitration. Critically, Your Honor, defendant has stated his argument, a crucial fact that is non-existent in the record. It's just been made up today.
Okay, well, let me
say five people are involved. Sir, this is critical. I beg you to let me say this.
Justice Bibas, we get to ask some questions. I want to ask about prejudice. You've been putting a lot of emphasis on prejudice. It's a fair point for you. But estoppel also deals with prejudice. So I want to understand why we should deal with prejudice through waiver. So my question is waiver a remedy for just any prejudice? Or is waiver doctrine a remedy for the specific kind of prejudice that results when a party has the right and power to compel arbitration, decides, I'm going to test the waters first and try to have it both ways, try out court if it goes well, and then if not, then I'll go over to arbitration. So which is it and why? Do you think it's a remedy for any prejudice or just that kind of prejudice?
No, it's prejudice. No, the prejudice that involved here is as follows. This is the prejudice. The prejudice is that in the absence of knowing about arbitration, plaintiff engaged in a lengthy litigation, spending untold dollars and time, and here's the key. This plaintiff turned down offers of settlement because she believed specifically that she would be able to represent the group. She selflessly did that.
But the group had not
had
been,
she
part of
been
the
told and had we known that arbitration was out there
of,
and that
Schley,
she would have rejected, she would have rejected, she would have accepted
Mr. Schley,
offers.
Breathe deeply, Mr. Schley. Right. Take an inhale, hold it in, slowly breathe out and relax. At the point you're talking about, the people with the arbitration clause were not part of the action, though.
They're never part of the act. Wait a second. They were part of the action. Here's the key point. Yes, I'll be happy to address it. According to counsel stated to your honors that there were five people involved that signed arbitration, and that therefore it was a tiny number, and therefore it wouldn't have had much effect on the case. The case would have had to go forward anyway. That number does not appear in the record. It is a number that was created today. And the number is in the record, and it's at page 2. It's referenced at page 2 of our opposition papers to your honors. And the number is 87. 87 employees signed arbitration agreements in the described class. Not 5, 87. And that was in 2014, mind you. And since then, for the last 6 years, people are still signing them. So how many are there now? Who knows how many? But it's not 5, it's 87. It is irresponsible for defendant to state a number that doesn't appear in the record and is adverse and is not even... Yeah.
Mr. Clay, Judge Bibas, can you cite any precedent, and I don't think the Sixth Circuit unpublished case fits this criterion, but you can tell me otherwise, in which that held that a party waived its right to compel based on litigation conduct that happened before any potential arbitration bound plaintiffs had joined the action? Is there a case that's on all fours with this case?
5 minutes.
Yes. They are cited in our brief.
Which?
To the court. I just don't have a top of my head, but I can tell you that there were numbers. The cases are cited in our brief to the district court and our briefs to your honors. It's a well established notion. I mean, this is not new. This has been standard law for decades.
Before a plaintiff had joined the action, where there's no opportunity to arbitrate before that person joined. You say that's settled for decades.
Yes.
Okay.
Without question. But again, I emphasize that the point that defendant has just made to your honors is that there were simply a handful of arbitrations agreement. So what's the big deal? The case was going to go forward in federal court anyway. When I'm pointing out to you it's a matter of record that 87 agreements were signed, not five. That, to me, is, I mean, changes everything.
Now you're breathing slowly. Let me just mention, I'm not sure how many times you've argued before us. You've got to pause to let us ask questions. It's very irritating to try to ask a question and the lawyer continues speaking.
I apologize.
I don't even know if I'm
following your direction.
Yeah, it is trickier on the phone. I understand you can't see the visual cues, but it's just.
I will adhere to your request, and I apologize.
No, so the exaggeration is not helpful. The voluminous, I think you said, voluminous opinion, or massive opinion, I think you said, of the court is 9 pages long. The opinion itself is 9 pages long, our prior opinion, at 748 and 742.
Are you talking to me, Your Honor?
Yes, you mentioned earlier you talked about all the work that was generated before this was asserted, and you're saying that was part of the prejudice, and you talked about the Third Circuit had come out with this. I think you didn't say humongous. I think you said massive opinion. And as I'm saying, the opinion is 9 pages long. Just the exaggeration. The only point I'm making, right. Exaggeration does not help your argument.
I don't.
Doesn't mean you're wrong.
I did. It's not. I'm sorry, but I don't see it to be 9 pages long. It was a presidential opinion involving multiple issues of first impression. The court went through successorship.
I'm looking right at it.
It went through joint employer. It went through single. It went through individual responsibility of a manager. It was a huge undertaking. And putting that aside, there were three district court opinions written even before that decision. And all that could have been avoided had we been told about this thing, because this would have been settled up front early on. And here we are 9 years later, and we wouldn't be here today but for the concealment of the arbitration. Why? Because once we were into it for 3.5 years, we had to go forward. It was no turning back. So we've spent 9 years litigating a case that could have been resolved based on an offer of judgment made a couple of months after the plaintiff filed the case. I mean, if that's not prejudice, I don't know what is.
One minute left.
Anything else you wanted to tell us, Mr. Story?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. We do understand your argument, and I think Ms. Batista reserves some time.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I just want to quickly address this case would be in the exact same position if defendants had disclosed the arbitration agreements during the period where motions to dismiss were being filed and were up on appeal. If defendants believed that it wasn't a very small part of their strategy, which it always has been, of course we would have revealed it earlier to plaintiff's counsel. To suggest that plaintiff's counsel would have, I don't know, withdrawn this action or not pursued it had he known about those arbitration agreements that still have very little impact on the case is completely disingenuous. And if defendants had believed that he wouldn't have pursued an appeal, we would have revealed them. But the point is that they weren't that impactful. And just as to the number,
they weren't what? I didn't hear that.
They weren't that impactful, and they didn't prejudice the case. This case was always contemplated as a class and or collective action that was going to go forward in federal court. The numbers that plaintiff's counsel has brought up, the 87 only is in relation to how many arbitration agreements were produced in discovery. That is not reflective of the number of individuals who are potentially part of this class, especially in light of litigation and the narrow geographic scope. And finally,
Go ahead.
I just want to make the point that similarly, certainly if we thought that the arbitration agreements would have had an effect during settlement negotiations, again, it would only have been to defendants' advantage to bring them up. Plaintiff's assertion that it was somehow advantageous for us to keep them quiet simply doesn't make sense. The motion to dismiss had nothing to do with those arbitration agreements and wouldn't have been affected by them.
Thank you, Ms. Batista. Thank both counsel for argument, and we'll take the matter under advisement.